Welcome back to the Gaming News Canada show. I am your host, Steve McAllister. Some 10 months ago, the Canadian Centre for Ethics in Sport and McLaren Global Sports Solutions hosted the first international symposium on match manipulation and gambling in sport. The symposium's purpose was to deepen the understanding by stakeholders of the threat that competition manipulation poses to the safety of athletes and sport integrity, and to make specific recommendations that will protect Canadian sport. This week, the two organizations released a white paper that brings together the combined learnings from that symposium and also symposium back in 2019 to provide a path forward for sport in this country. For more on the white paper and the process that led to its release this week, we are joined by Robert Copeland, the Senior Vice President of McLaren Global Sports Solutions and one of the authors of the white paper. Bob, it's great to see you again, and thanks so much for joining us on the Gaming News Canada show.
Happy to be with you, Steve.
Hey, Bob, let's just start with, I always like to kind of pull back the curtain and kind of let our audience know how the sausage gets made. And in terms of how this white paper came about, maybe just walk our audience through the process when the symposium wrapped up, I think, at the end of May a year ago, and to get to this point where the group has now come forth with recommendations. Who was involved in the writing of this report? And then we'll get into the recommendations a little bit later.
Sure, happy to do that. Actually, the symposium you referenced, which was in May 2023, was the second one. We commenced our first symposium. So this is McLaren Global Sport with the Canadian Centre for Ethics and Sport. We partnered on this. We did the first one in April of 2019. You know, we knew that potential for regulated gaming market in Canada was on the horizon. And so this, you know, this was certainly an issue that predated Bill C-218, you know, particularly with respect to match fixing in the, you know, the gray and black market. So, you know, once the Bill C-218 was passed, we thought it was necessary and quite frankly urgent to get all the stakeholders back in the room, because this is an issue that requires urgent attention. Just given, you know, all of the eyeballs that are on this issue, the amount, the prevalence of betting that's happening, which is a runaway freight train in the province of Ontario, to further protect, you know, sports, athletes, and quite frankly, the industry. Because if people don't know, don't have confidence that their bets are on the up and up, then it's going to be not good for anybody involved. So that's kind of the genesis of it. And stemming from that, we published, again, this is our second white paper. This is a much more exhaustive than the first one. It was co-published by our company and the Canadian Centre for Ethics and Sport. But obviously, it's drawn on input and perspectives from a lot of very important stakeholders. And really the purpose of these symposiums was, you know, to raise awareness and get all of the key stakeholders in the room. Nobody can do this alone. So, you know, some of those people who we've gathered input from them at the symposium, before the symposium, in surveys and constant communications and back and forth with these experts. So, you know, they include from, you know, law enforcement, Interpol, FBI were represented. Obviously, the gaming community, betting operators, integrity companies, regulators like the Alcohol and Gaming Commission of Ontario, among others. We had all the major North American professional sports leagues in attendance, as well as, you know, for example, the Canadian Premier League soccer in Canada, which is one of the most sought after sports for betting, as we understand. And then we even had several national sports organizations in Canada. So organizations like, you know, Canada Basketball, Hockey Canada, we had the Canadian Football League, you name it. And then what's really important is we had several athletes in attendance, Canadian Olympians, representatives, because really this starts with education of athletes who often are groomed and unwittingly into this type of activity. We can talk about that more in a minute. And then finally, you know, the NCAA was there, U Sports was there, and even provincial organizations like Ontario University Athletics were there. And I think this really shows just how much the topic is on the radar of these organizations nowadays.
Yeah, I think, Bob, you make such a great point about that what's at stake for everybody involved in sports betting. And it's not good for the business of sports betting operators if there are questions around integrity. Professional sports, I mean, integrity is first and foremost. So those are definitely key takeaways. I'd like to just walk through the recommendations, Bob, if that's okay, one by one. And because I think there's lots to talk about each of them. And you just mentioned it a second ago that the first recommendation is to develop a national policy for Canadian sport to address competition manipulation that is inclusive of all stakeholders, develop in consultation with athletes, adopted by all national and multi-sports organizations, and administered by an independent body. And I mean, the timing is pretty much bang on for this. I mean, we're in an Olympic year here, Bob. We know how prevalent sports betting, both legal and otherwise, is on Olympics, especially the Summer Olympics. And you and I also talked a little bit the day before we recorded this podcast just about the importance of finding funding to help take care of these programs. But let's start with that first recommendation and sure. What comes out of that for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, that recommendation in terms of developing the national policy for Canadian sport, that's being led by the Canadian Centre for Ethics in Sport, together with the support and of the Canadian Olympic Committee. And just if we back up a little bit, because we're talking kind of about governance in general, is, you know, we're starting to see governance reform. So when I say that, you know, specific policies on competition manipulation, advanced analytics, you know, with suspicious betting alerts, investigations, you know, a good example of that in Canada is the Canadian Football League, who prior to Bill C-218 didn't really have a competition manipulation policy. But I think now we work very closely with them to develop that, have a best-in-class policy, education, betting monitoring, et cetera, et cetera. But when you look at, you know, organizations that are maybe more obscure or under the radar, national sport federations in Canada, prior to Bill C-218, there wasn't really a reason for them to have a competition, or they thought there wasn't a reason for them to have a competition manipulation policy. And what we know is that it's these kind of more obscure sports and athletes who maybe are a little bit more under the radar, who maybe don't earn a living wage, they're more a more vulnerable population. These are the types of people who are more susceptible to match manipulation. So that kind of underscores that development of the national policy. And the CCS, over an 18-month period, did a pilot project with six Canadian national sport organizations. They were soccer, basketball, and by the way, soccer, in terms of prevalence globally, is the number one sport with respect to match manipulation. About two-thirds of all fixes are around soccer. Basketball is second. So basketball, soccer, curling, racquetball, squash, and badminton. So evolving from that, and what is in process right now is the development of this particular policy. So you mentioned the Olympics. So vulnerable population, you can bet on the Olympics, but the concept of betting on the Olympics is relatively new. So a lot of these national sports organizations, they don't understand the scope of the issue. They may not have appropriate policies in place, and athletes are generally not knowledgeable about these risks. So it's really, when we talk about the development of this policy, I like to equate it to a three-legged stool, where foundational is education. My gosh, we hear about Shohei Ohtani, and we can delve into that in a minute. But if Ohtani and his handlers aren't aware of these policies, can you imagine the lack of awareness for a national sport athlete? So education's one leg on the stool, policy development, and then enforcement mechanisms. So these are all factors that we examined at the symposium and in the white paper, and then underscore that particular recommendation.
Hey, Bob, on the education piece, I think, you know, we were on another podcast talking about the Ohtani situation. And for those who haven't heard, big story that broke on Thursday about Ohtani's interpreter being involved in a large gambling debts with a legal bookmaker. There's some fuzziness around whether or not Ohtani helped pay off the gambling debt, or the interpreter, as Ohtani's lawyers accused, stole funds from Ohtani to pay for those debts. And Ohtani's interpreter actually said he didn't realize that betting on sports was illegal in California. So obviously, as we record this podcast, this is a story with a lot of moving parts. But you know, sports betting has been around for a long time, Bob. But it does seem that with regulation, and especially in North America, starting with PASPA in 2018, and then, as you mentioned, the passing of Bill C-218 in the summer of 2021, it certainly appears to be on the radar a lot more with folks in the sporting community today.
Yeah, absolutely. And that underscores our second recommendation arising from the white papers, to develop a comprehensive educational programming. And it's athletes themselves who are calling for this. You know, if we look at the kind of the four golden rules for athletes when we talk about this issue, is the first one, it's, you know, seems quite obvious, but, you know, don't fix the competition and always, you know, compete to the best of your abilities. You know, don't bet on your sport or any event at the Olympic Games. You know, you have to understand, when you look at Major League Baseball or the NFL or the CFL, certainly players are forbidden from betting on their own sports, but in many cases they're free to bet on other sports.
Right.
But you know, the devil is in the details. The NFL, who had issues last year, they, you know, players can bet on other sports, but you can't do it from an NFL facility. So that's the nuance of the policy. The third golden rule is don't share information about health issues and sport tactics. So this speaks to insider information, which is, I think, what is at stake, one of the issues at stake with Ohtani. And then the last one is to speak up, if you witness or suspect competition manipulation, you have to report it. And again, this education ties to policy. Specific organizations, and we work with many, will have requirements that you are required to cooperate, required to report. So you can't just be sitting on the sidelines. You can be sanctioned for non-cooperation, as an example. But when I saw the Ohtani situation, it certainly has the earmarks of, you know, insider information. And sometimes this is done by design, but oftentimes it can be done unwittingly, which underscores the need for education. So, you know, the Ohtani situation illustrates how the entourage is linked to players. So in this case, it was his interpreter, but, you know, it could be a manager, an agent, a doctor, or a family friend. So they can all these people can be a cog related to betting improprieties or fixing games. And strong competition manipulation policies talk about not sharing this insider information for this very reason. It can be exploited, you know, by the bad actors. And again, people may not even understand that they might be doing something wrong. And that's also how kind of the grooming can start, if somebody, a bad actor, latches onto that information, and then they can get the athlete in their grasp and exploit them even further.
Bob, in terms of, like, you know, there was a time probably, you know, maybe up until 5 years ago, where doping was the biggest red flag in Olympic sport. And obviously, there's a feeling among many people that there's a safe sport crisis in Canada right now. Where does match manipulation kind of rank for you in terms of Olympic athletes in this country, and how relevant or how important education needs to be?
Well, I think it ranks pretty, it's important, maybe not necessarily in terms of prevalence, but in terms of awareness. Olympic athletes have been, you know, battered over the head with, you know, anti-doping, performance-enhancing drugs. They're very kind of familiar with the routine, so to speak. But a lot more ground needs to be made up because of this relatively new issue, particularly in North America with legalized sports betting. There are larger, I think, business economic arguments that underscore the need for integrity with respect to betting and match fixing. You know, our interest in sport is predicated on the uncertainty of outcome. I mean, you could make the case that doping is a form of match manipulation, right? But we're talking really in the context of betting here. So, you know, interest in sport is predicated on the uncertainty of the outcome. And this is foundational to the sports betting market. So if we don't protect against this, then the betting industry will be impacted. People won't wager on games where there's a question about the legitimacy of the outcome. And then, you know, I guess more importantly, our regulatory frameworks now will not allow betting on sports that do not meet certain standards of compliance. We can get into that if you want later with, you know, example, you know, fairly recently with the UFC, where the AGCO pulled the opportunity to bet on them. So, you know, we have these frameworks, we have this stick in the AGCO that requires betting operators to provide assurances that these sporting organizations have these policies in place. But, you know, back to your question about athletes and the importance for athletes, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So it's important for us to convey to athletes how they can kind of get caught up in this web unwittingly, as well as their, you know, responsibilities under a code of conduct to report and all the things I mentioned. So we really think this is a health and safety issue, particularly as it relates to vulnerable athletes who in many cases are groomed into these match fixing schemes. Certainly there are athletes that are protagonists and, you know, may want to take the lead and make a little extra money here and there, but oftentimes they're groomed into these schemes. So they can be kind of unwitting victims. We talked a lot about that at the symposium, and the athletes certainly share this concern for the health and safety issues. So what's great about this is there seems to be, at least from the athlete representative community, a real appetite to educate their fellow athletes about the issue. So, you know, when we talk about Olympic sports, and this isn't a knock, it's just kind of a reality that the vast majority of athletes who get caught up in this are athletes competing under the radar.
Right.
They're low paid, they're more vulnerable. You know, that's typical of many athletes in Canada. Many amateur athletes in Canada don't earn a living wage. So they're vulnerable to these types of approaches. But also maybe the temptation of betting on their own competitions. We had a speaker at the symposium, Jordan Spencer from the United Kingdom. And, you know, he was having trouble eating, you know, toiling away in some semi-professional leagues, played on the national teams. And he bet on basketball, and he didn't bet to lose. He just, you know, he kind of used the information he knew, thought he could make a few extra bucks. And, you know, it's affected his career. To his credit, he's out and is speaking about it. So there's also the temptation of betting on your own volition. So, you know, the lack of organizational policies and mandatory education leaves athletes and I think the whole Canadian sport community exposed.
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, Bob, I mean, soccer, basketball, and tennis are the three sports that have the biggest problems when it comes to match fixing. And it's not the Premiership or the NBA or Wimbledon or, you know, the WTA and ATP Tour major tennis events. It's those second tiers, what you call challengers and satellite tournaments on the tennis tour. It's those lower tier soccer and basketball leagues. Those are where these infractions tend to be taking place.
A word from our sponsor.
Hey there, sports fans. Are you looking for fresh and fun takes on the hottest topics in Canadian sports? Well, we've got just what you need. Introducing Homestand Sports Today, your go-to daily sports newsletter, bringing you the Canadian angle on the hottest NHL, NBA, footy stories, and more right to your inbox. But wait, there's more. Homestand Sports isn't just another text-heavy newsletter. Every story has its own video featuring our talented hosts like me, Albert Vartanian, giving you a newsletter experience like never before. And did I mention it's a free subscription? Subscribe now at homestand.ca.
Now back to the show.
I just want to go back to what you said a few moments ago too, Bob, and that's, you know, beyond the athletes. I mean, the athletes have a big support system around them. You have coaches and medical staff and nutritionists and sports psychologists, and then you have agents and friends and family. And, you know, I just wonder, educating the athletes is obviously a step in the right direction, but there's also too, is there a way to educate those people around athletes or to make those people aware of the danger you put an athlete in if you start asking about the health condition of one of their competitors or oftentimes it might just be innocent information. There are lots of people out there that aren't betting on sports, but maybe asking a question that could get an athlete in hot water.
No, absolutely. You're bang on there, Steve. It's not just about the athletes. It's all the people that you mentioned. If we look at the upcoming Olympics, I mentioned that the Canadian Center, in addition to working with the COC on kind of a national platform, developed an online education program, and they're delivering this online. I believe they may have delivered it to recently to Canadian entourage involved with the recent Youth Olympics that just wrapped up in February. But I think the plan is to make this available to all athletes and athlete, you know, writ large grouping, all the people you talk to, we'll call them athlete support personnel from, you know, trainers, therapists, et cetera. So I understand that the plan is to have all of them, you know, participate in this education for those that are going to Paris. You know, when in a kind of a previous life, I was the athletic director at the University of Waterloo, Steve, and we had a pretty significant doping issue. And to your point, you know, education was a big miss, but it wasn't just the athletes who needed the education. It was the coaches and others. And subsequent to that particular issue, it became mandatory within U Sports or Canadian inter-university sports at the time that, you know, a football coach couldn't step on the field unless they also had taken that mandatory anti-doping education. So I think the same kind of message applies in this context. It'll take time, but I think we're on the right track.
Hey, before we get to the next recommendation, Bob, I think it's a good time to bring up the funding piece. And this is something, again, that you and I talked about before the podcast and, you know, something that I've beaten the drum a little bit with in the previous Gaming News Canada newsletter about that this regulated industry in Ontario in particular is bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars to the Ontario government. And I think there's a good story to tell for the province by steering money towards problem gambling programs or mental health addiction programs. And we all know the financial stress that many NSOs are seeing in this country right now. And when you and I have a conversation like this and people listen to it, the first thing that's going to come up with, well, how is the sports system going to pay for that? And I know that that's something that's certainly top of mind with both you and Richard McLaren.
Yeah, I mean, funding is fundamental to this, as we've talked about in terms of the vulnerability of athletes. And, you know, we have a financial crisis in Canadian sport, and you layer that on top of, I completely agree, a safe sport. Let's just call it an integrity crisis, which involves safe sport, you know, which is, you know, is harassment, is match fixing, all of those types of things. Very, very expensive to develop all these programs. So, you know, I think it was just this month that Deloitte came out with a study, and they suggested it was over $100 million. I think it was like $104 million increase to funding for NSOs. So we know the issue is there. There hasn't been any increases for 20 years. And the majority of these NSOs are relying on the federal funding for their existence. So when you layer on the integrity issues we're talking about today, it's all going to require additional resource to combat that. So one of the recommendations, tying it back to our recommendations is to ensure that, or to advocate that a certain percentage of bets that are placed be earmarked for these types of programs to help fund these types of programs. So really to develop a revenue sharing system from the proceeds of sport gambling so that an appropriate percentage, we can talk about what might be appropriate, is allotted to sport. And the emphasis on that should be on community sport development and harm reduction. And this is something that many, many people are advocating for, including people like Bruce Kidd, Professor Emeritus, Sport and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. You know, he's advocating for this specifically as it relates to gambling addiction. So I think that's one, we think, realistic solution. You know, think about this. I don't know what the actual betting handle was in 2023 in terms of the amount of online wagers. In Ontario alone, I think it was many billions, maybe as high as $50 billion. If you took not 1%, if you took 0.25% of that and allocated it to sport, and you're talking about, you know, over $125 million. So, a small sliver of this pie would go a long way to solving some of these particular resource issues. So I think when it comes to, you know, amateur sport, you know, national sport organizations, provincial sport organizations in Canada, we really need to look at a new paradigm of funding. It can't just be consistently, you know, waiting for the government to bail you out. The majority of our NSOs and PSOs, there just isn't enough corporate support in this country to make up the difference. And there's not enough advertising revenue through our media to support that. So we definitely have to look at new opportunities.
Yeah, that's a great topic for a whole separate podcast, Bob, for sure. I mean, the other thing I'll mention on the funding piece, too, is that why we have a very competitive marketplace in Ontario with almost 50 operators plus the Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation. You do have provincial lottery and gaming corporations across the rest of the country that are doing quite well when it comes to generating revenue from online sports betting and gaming. And that's another, you know, perhaps that's another well to tap into for programs like the ones you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. That's you know, I think part of the same type of structure to look outside our typical funding sources.
Hey, Bob, I want to go to the next recommendation, and that's creating a national working group to advise on the administration of a national policy and sharing regulatory and policy best practices and with a few other details. I just wonder, like, what would that working group look like, and you know, what types of people and what backgrounds would have a seat at that table?
You know, going back to my initial comments, anybody with an interest in this should have a seat at the table, right? So otherwise it's not going to be effective. So we need the funders, we need the regulators, we need the athletes. Those are all the types of people that would be involved in that. National multi-sport organization, provincial sport gambling regulators, law enforcement. You know, a lot of people may not understand that the vast majority of betting is offshore. So it's not always channeled within our local community. So it's a very, very complicated issue when you think about, you know, prosecution and law enforcement. So all of these people need to be at the table, you know, including the betting operators. And I think everybody has an interest to be at that table, which was evidenced by, you know, the very broad cross-section of people that participated in the symposium.
And I think, the betting operators bring a couple of different perspectives. One, I think they're, as we mentioned earlier, their business is impacted by integrity or lack thereof in sport. And also we've seen several of these operators have partnerships with NSOs and professional sport leagues. And we've had a chance to have many people from operators appear on this podcast and who we spoke with the newsletter. And a lot of those people have sports and sports media backgrounds. So they absolutely should be included in that mix.
Yeah, I mean, it's in everybody's best interest, including the, you know, the sports betting operators. You know, if you look at the Canadian Football League, for example, who has sponsorship relationships with these operators as a league and the team, an important source of revenue, you know, you see it on the jersey patches, etc. So, you know, if you're a player in the CFL, you're exposed to these betting messages on a daily basis, constantly. And that type of awareness, you know, who knows, that could lead to an increase in betting on their sport and consequently carries a greater risk of competition manipulation. So, you know, that's why organizations are turning their attention to this, you know, prevention, where education is the key. And I know that the betting operators are very interested in being part of the solution.
Yeah,
they're not the bad guy. Absolutely not.
Yeah, no, and I know it's also a priority with Paul Burns from the Canadian Gaming Association. I believe Paul spoke at the symposium last year, and Paul has certainly been an advocate on one of the reasons why regulated gambling needs to happen across the country. Is, you know, the integrity of sport is one of those priorities.
Yeah, absolutely, fully aligned with that. They've been very supportive of this.
Hey, but I think we kind of covered off the revenue sharing piece or the funding piece. That's the fourth recommendation, Bob. So we'll skip to number five. And again, I think one thing that's important for our audience to understand, that I'm sure if you follow the world of sports betting, you've seen Macklin Convention brought up a few times over the last 3 years. So I was really hoping, Bob, can you explain to people what the Macklin Convention is and why there has been a push for the federal government of Canada to participate in this convention?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, first of all, the full name of this is called the Convention on the Manipulation of Sports Competitions. And it was shortened to the Macklin Convention after the place where it was constituted, which was Macklin, Switzerland. So this, you know, governments around the world have different approaches to this particular issue, and this was an attempt to try to develop, just like we talked about trying to develop a harmonized policy in Canada, to try to provide a harmonized approach internationally. So you can imagine the challenges right now. We don't even have a national harmonized approach in Canada, so we're behind the eight ball. But that's kind of the background or the intent of the Macklin Convention, is to try to look at this as a, you know, this is an international global issue. I've mentioned offshore betting. So it requires more of a harmonized international global approach. I mentioned we had Interpol and FBI at our symposium. So the Macklin Convention, it's the only rule of international law on this issue of competition manipulation. And it provides, as I mentioned, it's really a roadmap for countries who want to address this issue domestically. So common definitions and how you might structure a national platform. So that certainly is in the sights of organizations like the Canadian Center for Ethics and Sport, you know, but the decision to become a signatory to the Macklin Convention rests with the government of Canada. So what it does is, and this underlies why it maybe is problematic right now for Canada to join, is it requests public authorities in all these different international jurisdictions to cooperate with sports organizations, betting operators, and others to kind of prevent this issue. So it proposes a common legal framework for how this might be combated internationally. So what you have to understand is this is largely a European tool. It was developed by the Council of Europe. It's been signed by 32 European states, but not a lot beyond that. You know, they welcome other countries who've adopted kind of this unified approach. I think Australia, Morocco, they're involved. But the issue of the common legal framework, I think, might be the reason why it's problematic right now for Canada, notwithstanding what I just said about we don't even have a national platform right now. So, you know, Canada remains limited in its ability to prosecute match fixing because there are no specific provisions in our criminal code. But we're not alone in that. There are very few countries across the world who have specific provisions in their criminal code for match fixing. I would think that I think in the UK, they've got some betting related match fixing episodes that can be punished under the offense of cheating and gambling, but case law is really rare. Match fixing is embedded in a few other countries in their criminal code, in Bulgaria and Spain, or in some specific criminal law provisions in some other countries. But we're way behind the eight ball here in Canada. So that might be, you know, the reluctance. I mean, I can't speak on behalf of the government of Canada, but that's just my assessment of why they haven't yet signed it. But, you know, I'm hopeful with, you know, some of the momentum that we've had. We're moving towards a national policy. There's much greater awareness. And you know what, Steve, we've got the, you know, the World Cup coming up, and,
yeah,
you know, we had an issue with match fixing long before the regulated market back in, I think, 2012, and it arose from a very sophisticated investigation of criminal networks in Germany that exposed match fixing. So we need to be vigilant.
Yeah, such a great point, Bob. It's funny, but when the Otani story broke this week, people right away refer to the sports betting ads on TV, and it's all this legal sports betting now, and we forget that sports betting has been around forever, and corruption in sport has been around forever, and this isn't a new problem. But not doesn't mean that it's not any less serious, and that it has to be dealt with. And I think the digital world we live in today, that's put on a whole other layer that makes it so hard to detect and to take action against. It's a much bigger world now, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, even it's striking when, you know, your reference to Otani, you know. If players at the highest echelons of the sport are not in tune with the rules around gambling, particularly in Major League Baseball, with the history of gambling, you know, Pete Rose, et cetera, highly publicized history and longstanding rules and regulations with respect to that, it certainly demonstrates the urgent need to educate and develop policies for everybody else that are, you know, really at the grassroots of this particular issue.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, you know, when you talk about the Macklin Convention and the laws in Canada right now, like what do you see as the major challenges right now when it comes to dealing with match fixing and corruption in sport in Canada?
Well, I mentioned our legal structure and our constitutional structure poses issues, but you know, and some people are may not support criminalizing this. It would be covered under, you know, different types of statutes, fraud, what's that, etc. But that doesn't really allow you to, you know, very narrowly focus on the larger issue of match fixing, you know, triangulating it, looking at these criminal networks. So it's not as effective. And, you know, the argument for criminalizing this, you know, match fixing, it brings to the surface, you know, links to, again, not all match fixing is linked to criminal networks, but a majority of it, and the egregious stuff happens with these bad actors. So it brings these links to, you know, other criminal activities, corruptions, organized crime, money laundering, etc. And the magnitude of the problem, it indicates that you need to address it through, you know, various law enforcement tools, investigation mechanisms. And this all needs to be codified. So it's not codified right now. A bit of the Wild West. So that's kind of the, you know, the reason that we need to move in that direction. And I think that, you know, in fact, a criminal justice response against match fixing would demonstrate that, you know, sporting manipulation, it's not just a breach of sporting rules, but it's also an offense against the public, I guess, in a broader sense. So that would be kind of my elevator speech to why we need to move in that direction, you know, notwithstanding the kind of the structural challenges, maybe some of the political challenges of why Canada hasn't stepped up to the plate yet with the Macklin Convention.
Yeah, good stuff. And I think just on the education piece again, Bob, like we're probably going to have, what, 300, 400, 500 athletes going to Paris this summer representing Canada, and that doesn't include support staff. And you and I, I'm sure, have both. I'm a minor hockey coach. I've taken various courses, and again, it's just trying to get that information in front of many people as possible. And to your point about Otani earlier, making sure that sports betting and integrity in sport and corruption is on the radar of anybody who's got skin in the game when it comes to the Olympics.
100%. But you know, you have to understand these high performance Olympic athletes, carded athletes in Canada, they're absolutely deluged with policies and procedures and manuals and books and pages. We need to look at delivering this in the, you know, a more effective way and not just kind of hand them the, you know, check the box, so to speak. So I think it's not only the need for education, but it's the way in which we deliver it and get the point across. And I think in that regard, it's telling stories, it's athletes leading this, it's testimonials. It's not a top-down type of approach. And that's why it was so important for us to have athletes represented at the symposium and people like I mentioned, Jordan Spencer from the UK. You know, when you hear these stories, that resonates much more effectively than checking the policy box.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you had a great story telling me before the podcast about the fight in Orlando a few weeks ago and what happened there in terms of an instance of corruption in sport.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting one. It does underscore kind of where we are in the cycle. So if you want, I can just spend a very brief amount of time summarizing that, Steve.
Yeah, please do.
And by the way, this is all public information. There was a Wall Street Journal article on this for anybody who's interested in, and you can get across the paywall. This came out in January. But so this involved the World Boxing Association, so WBA event in Orlando, Florida in December. So again, it was in the Wall Street Journal. So it raised some considerable suspicions for this to be written about. So someone walked into the Seminole Hard Rock Casino in Hollywood, Florida, and they attempted to place a $500,000 bet for a relatively obscure super welterweight bout. So the bet was that the bout would last more than 5.5 rounds. So again, it wasn't a bet on someone throwing a match, that type of thing. So this is kind of an example of a spot bet or a spot fix, perhaps, is the allegation, I would suppose. So the bet, the bout would last for more than 5.5 rounds. So the issue beyond the amount itself, which would trigger a betting alert, is the fact that the person placing the bet was the manager of one of the fighters and the manager of the heavily favored fighter. So there's a couple of pretty significant red flags. You know, and I mentioned the golden rule when we talk about education and betting policy, and a fundamental requirement, by the way, of the Alcohol and Gaming Commission of Ontario is you can't have insider betting. So here you have, you know, the manager of a fighter placing a bet. There's no policy or regulations in the WA that prevent that. But again, there was probably no need for them to have such a policy prior to the legalization of sports betting in the United States. So, you know, I get it. So what happened was this was so alarming that the casino, they wouldn't accept the $500,000 bet. They accepted a reduced value. I don't think it was in the neighborhood of $100,000. But there were also several additional attempted wagers. And this is what gets, you know, creates the betting alert. So, you know, herein you see the problem, Steve, for the potential for competition manipulation in absence of, you know, a strong policy. But right now, what the AGCO in Ontario and other regulators have is they have a pretty big stick. So and there's an example with I think it was the Ultimate Fighting Championship not too long ago, where there was a suspicious match, and the AGCO pulled betting on the UFC, So that's a good thing. It shows that the system's working and the AGCO and the UFC work together. They address the issue. It's much stronger now. So we're kind of in a little bit of a wild west, and it's going to take some time to improve these things. But you know, I think we're on the right path.
No, that's a good way to put it, Bob. It is the wild west right now, and things hopefully will keep moving in the right direction. Hey, Bob, final question. I mean, there's five recommendations in this white paper. I just wonder, was there some whittling down involved to get to those five?
Not necessarily. You know, we don't want to overwhelm people with dozens of recommendations, and you can't see the forest for the trees. So I think we were pretty surgical with those five. They speak for themselves. They're equally important, and we're making progress on all of them. So again, it's about the community, all of the stakeholders getting together. We're seeing great progress in that area. We're glad to be a part of it. And, you know, we're on the front lines of this as a company. We've Richard McLaren has done significant investigations on this topic. He's the independent integrity officer for FIBA. You know, we're involved in investigations. We see this on a ground level. So we see how it works. We see the impacts. So I think we're pretty confident that these are the important recommendations at this stage of the game.
If you want to read the entire white paper, you can go to the Canadian Center for Ethics and Sports website at cces.ca. And Bob Copeland is the Senior Vice President of McLaren Global Sports Solutions. Bob, great cross paths with you once again. You and I spent some time together in the Canadian University sports system 5 or 6 years ago, and always enjoyed our time together then, and really enjoyed spending time with you today, and look forward to getting you back here on the podcast at some point, maybe after the Paris Olympics this summer.
Likewise, Steve. I was happy to touch base, and if we can be of any help, glad to talk again.
As always, you can find this podcast on gamingnewscanada.ca and on the various podcast platforms. Thanks again to Bob Copeland for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you again here on the Gaming News Canada show.
Thank you for listening to the Gaming News Canada show. Sign up for our newsletter at gamingnewscanada.ca. Follow Steve McAllister on LinkedIn. Message Steve if you're interested in being a sponsor or featured guest.